Case number 08-7074, Ralph Nader et al. Appellants versus Democratic National Committee et al. Mr. Hall for the appellants, Mr. Sandler for the appellees.
Good morning, Your Honors. Oliver Hall for the appellants, and I'd like to reserve 2 minutes for rebuttal. May it please the Court, during the 2004 presidential election, the Democratic National Committee and its allies filed 29 complaints against the Nader-Camejo campaign, 24 of which were dismissed, in a deliberate attempt to drain the candidates' time, money, and resources. Based on these facts, the plaintiffs have stated claims for abuse of process, malicious prosecution, and civil conspiracy. This court should reverse the district court's dismissal of those claims for three reasons. First, the district court violated the cardinal rule governing motions to dismiss by failing to accept plaintiffs' allegations as true. Second, the district court erroneously applied the Knorr-Pennington doctrine to confer immunity upon the defendants for their common law torts. And third, the district court abused its discretion by maintaining jurisdiction over these state law claims and by disposing of these claims by repeatedly relying upon cases that have been reversed or vacated. These errors require reversal because the plaintiffs have not had their opportunity to prove the allegations in their well-pleaded complaint.
Can I ask you to start, though, with the defendant's argument that the case is barred by the statute of limitations?
Yes, Your Honor. There are at least two reasons why that argument cannot sustain the judgment in this case. Uh-huh. The first is that the defendants engaged in numerous acts of fraudulent concealment that prevented the candidates and the voter plaintiffs from discovering their cause of action during the 2004 election. The DNC, for example, denied that it had any involvement in these 29 complaints filed in 19 different tribunals across the nation. The Kerry Edwards campaign likewise denied that they had any involvement in this litigation. After the election, Federal Election Commission reports confirm that the DNC retained many of the law firms that filed these lawsuits. Likewise, the amended complaint includes emails and other documentation from the DNC, from the Kerry Edwards campaign, indicating that these parties were involved.
Right, but the defendants say the amended complaint, which is very, very specific, also includes facts which quite clearly reveal the conspiracy, the alleged conspiracy, prior to the election.
Your Honor,
let me give you an example or two, okay? Paragraph 62 of the complaint. Do you have it in front of you?
I do not have the complaint, but I'm familiar with
the paragraph. Paragraph 62. It cites an August 04 Washington Post article.
Yes.
Okay. Which says, as defendant Moffitt admitted to the Washington Post in August 04. Now, that's 3 months before the election and over 3 years before the complaint was filed here. Quote, we wanted to neutralize his campaign by forcing him to spend money and resources defending these things, but much to our amazement, we've actually been more successful than we thought we'd be. That's the conspiracy that you're claiming.
Your Honor, it is, but the difference here is that was one party, and what was not disclosed to the plaintiffs during the election was the coordinated nature of this effort.
Let's continue reading the article. It refers to Mr. Nader as, quote, dogged by an unprecedented public relations and legal campaign against him by the Democratic Party and like-minded groups.
Your Honor,
I mean, it's right there in the article.
It is, Your Honor, but the dispositive issue here is that the DNC at the same time was claiming that it had no involvement.
Right, but the standard here, you agree, the standard here is did the plaintiff know or should the plaintiff reasonably have known?
Well, Your Honor, I suppose that the issue here is the diligence of the plaintiffs in discovering that there was a cause of action. This court has recognized, and it's a matter of law, that the diligence of a plaintiff in discovering a cause of action is not to be determined at the motion to dismiss stage, particularly here where we have numerous allegations of fraudulent concealment by the defendants. Now, certainly...
Well, but if we can look at the complaint and find in the complaint evidence in the form of newspaper articles that reveal the conspiracy that you are alleging, what more is needed? Why? I'm not sure what more would be needed here.
Your Honor, what more is needed is evidence that this was a coordinated effort. At the time that
that's your case. That's actually what you would have to prove to win your case. The question here is whether the plaintiff knew of the conspiracy, the alleged conspiracy, in time to file within the statute of limitations. That's the question.
Your Honor.
Right? And certainly you're right that this doesn't prove the existence of it, but I mean, let me give you another example. Paragraph 45. This talks about the Four Seasons hotel meeting before the convention, okay? And the complaint quotes the Hartford Courant, quote, "We're not going to let him do it again." And then the article goes on and says, "The Four Seasons group is spearheading an attack on Nader that promises new coordination and sophistication. It is using the Democratic Convention as a way to combine its previously independent efforts and focus them more effectively." That's your claim.
But, Your Honor, at that time, if these plaintiffs had attempted to file a claim alleging a conspiracy, they very likely may have been thrown out of court for making conclusory allegations based on parallel conduct. What was missing at that time, Your Honor, was some evidence that this was a conspiracy and not, as the defendants claimed at that time,
You have one of the defendants here conceding it's a conspiracy. You have one of the defendants actually saying that this is a coordinated effort to keep Mr. Nader off the ballot.
What that defendant said, Your Honor, was that his organization, the Ballot Project, was a 527 group which was incorporated for the purpose of litigating against the Nader Camejo campaign. That does not establish that 527 organization was coordinating its efforts with the DNC or with the...
I just read you one of the sentences which referred to the Democratic Party.
The Democratic Party, Your Honor, what those articles tend to suggest is that Democrats generally were involved. And again, the Democratic Party, if we're speaking about defendant DNC right now, the DNC was denying the very facts that you're asserting that the plaintiffs should have known. The DNC denied that it was involved in this effort. It was only after the election, when Federal Election Commission reports came out, that it could be determined that, in fact, the DNC's representations at that time did not appear to be accurate. Likewise, with the Kerry Edwards campaign, Senator Kerry at the time of the election denied that his campaign was involved in this effort. It was only after the election, when emails and other evidence became available, that it was possible to determine that this was a coordinated effort involving these defendants.
I thought you were going to make an argument that in 2004 the Democratic Party wasn't organized enough to have a conspiracy.
That may be the case too, Your Honor.
Let me ask you, when is the date at which you all knew? When, according to your theory, when would the clock start running on these statutes of limitations?
Your Honor, the best answer I can give to that at this point is that it happened sometime after the conclusion of the election. And that's when the evidence that I
And remind me when you all filed. It's October 2007?
Correct.
Okay.
Correct. So
you
we're well.
You had a lot of time to think about that question. When does the clock start running?
Your Honor.
And the best answer you can give is sometime later. I mean, the statute of limitations is on the books. You know you're faced with a problem.
Yes.
You say the time that the events happen are not when it starts running, but you can't give us any alternative.
Well, Your Honor, I give some answer, which is that the statute of limitations must have started running after the conclusion of the election. It's a question
that's
that...
That's not... All right, so it's, if it started the day after the election, it's run out.
No, that's not true, because we did file in October of 2007.
That leads to my next question. You style some of your cause of action as an abusive process.
Yes.
But aren't these really malicious prosecution? What was the abusive process? Everything I see in your complaint talks about filing lawsuits, beginning litigation. That sounds malicious prosecution, and that's a one-year statute. The abusive process is once litigation has begun, that there's some abuse within the litigation itself. So where's your abusive process claim?
Correct, Your Honor. The gist of the abusive process tort is the misuse of process, the perversion of process for an improper purpose that's not within the purview of the law. The allegations here are that the proceedings themselves were instituted in order to drain, distract, and bankrupt.
That's malicious prosecution. What you just
but,
when you,
but
when
Your
you
Honor,
say it's instituted, so when that lawsuit is filed, if you're right, you have a claim for malicious prosecution. Now, beyond that, they're not the same tort, right? It's a
they are not
tort.
The same
so,
tort.
So what? Where's the abusive process come
from? The abusive process is in the use of a pattern of baseless and repetitive claims filed in 19 different tribunals nationwide as part of a coordinated effort to drain...
That's a pattern of malicious prosecution. That's not abusive process.
You
have to cite something in one of those cases that was an abuse... Of the process of the court in that case.
Your Honor, in California Motor Transport, that's exactly what the Supreme Court said was an abuse of process. That's the paradigmatic example, a pattern of baseless repetitive claims filed for the purpose of inflicting harm directly by means of the process itself.
What's the case you cited again?
California Motor Transport, Your Honor, versus Trucking Unlimited. The Supreme Court recognized that that a pattern of baseless, repetitive claims may emerge, which leads the fact finder to conclude.
This is a state law question, isn't it?
It is, Your Honor.
Okay, was that involving D.C. law?
Well, the applicable law we submit would be the District of Columbia law.
And we have a case called Morphosis versus Baum. You know about that case, right?
Yes.
Okay. In that case, the complaint was styled an abuse of process claim. But because it alleged malice and lack of probable cause, which you do, we construed it as a malicious prosecution claim and applied the one-year statute.
Correct. And Your Honor.
So isn't that this case?
No, it's not, Your Honor. Often, as the court recognized in the early case Sophos v. Eaton when this tort was first recognized, at that time the court did not distinguish between abuse of process and malicious prosecution. But the distinction is now recognized that abuse of process involves the perversion of the process, whereas malicious prosecution involves the wrongful initiation of process. But the gist of the claim here is that the ongoing...
Let me ask you this. This is just a hypothetical question. If we were to conclude that the newspaper articles and other things identified in the complaint revealed the cause of action prior to the election, we wouldn't have to decide which statute of limitation applies, correct?
No, Your
because
Honor.
That's more than 3 years. That would even not satisfy the three-year statute, right?
No, Your Honor, because the second reason that I wanted to get to with respect to the statute of limitations argument here is that this is a continuing tort, and the conduct, the wrongful conduct that was initiated first during the 2004 election is still ongoing in terms of, in the context.
Well, let me ask you about that. The theory of your case, your complaint, your cause of action is that The cause of action is that the defendants conspired to file these lawsuits in order to deprive Mr. Nader of the resources to participate in the 04 election, right?
Correct.
Okay. And you, I assume, agree that in order to have a continuing tort, one of the key elements is, and I'm quoting from a D.C. Circuit case, quote, damages flowing from the act as a whole, right?
Yes.
Okay. So how can anything that happened after the 04 election possibly relate to your basic cause of action, which was, according to your theory, to deny Mr. Nader of the resources to participate in the 04 election?
Well, Your Honor, speaking more broadly, the issue here is whether this litigation was instituted for the improper purpose of inflicting direct harm by means of the process itself.
That isn't the way you pledge your case.
That's not the way you plead the complaint. That's not the complaint.
Your Honor, in the complaint...
The complaint is quite specific. It's to deny Mr. Nader, it's to keep him off the ballot and to deny him of the resources to participate in the election. That's what you say again and again, to drain him of resources.
But, Your Honor, that effort is not inconsistent with the ongoing effort to inflict financial harm. And we do allege...
But that's not what this lawsuit is about. Right. They may be doing all sorts of other mean things to Mr. Nader today. They might be doing all sorts of mean things to other people. But your lawsuit is alleged in terms of a conspiracy to subject him to vexatious litigation to drain his resources in order to deprive him of the ability to participate in the election.
But, Your Honor, that certainly was the primary purpose, but the wrongful...
That's what your lawsuit's about, isn't it?
Correct, but, Your Honor, the amended complaint specifically alleges that the purpose of this litigation was to inflict financial injury by means of the sheer burden of the litigation itself. That effort is still going on.
To make it impossible for him to participate in the election.
Well, that was certainly the primary goal, Your Honor,
right.
But that does not mean...
And that goal can't possibly continue after the election.
The wrongful conduct certainly can continue after the election and is continuing after the election.
It may be, but that might be the subject of some other lawsuit. But this one is about the attempt to deprive him of the ability to compete in the election.
Your Honor, I respectfully would disagree with that because this lawsuit is about the conspiracy that initiated in 2004 and which remains ongoing today. Certainly the object of that conspiracy...
No, a lawsuit can't be about a conspiracy. It has to be about a conspiracy to commit a tort. There is no cause of action just for civil conspiracy.
Correct.
Right?
But the
tort... And the tort which your complaint seems to rely upon is the tortious deprival of the ability to compete in the election by reason draining his resources. Is that not correct?
Your Honor, that is, as I concede, that is the primary purpose of the conspiracy, which was effected by means of the tortious abuse of process. And that tortious abuse of process is ongoing. Your Honor, in the District of Columbia, Mr. Nader's bank accounts are subject to writs of attachment at this very time because the law firm Reed Smith is attempting...
Well, they're subject to writs of attachment because there's a court order saying they're entitled to counsel fees and he didn't pay them, right?
Correct, Your Honor. That's not
a tort.
Your Honor,
If you've got a court order, if you've got a judgment against somebody, you can collect it.
Your Honor, this court, the D.C. State Court has recognized that the attempt to enforce a judgment that was wrongfully procured by means of fraud or other misconduct is equivalent to the tort of malicious prosecution. And that's exactly what's going on here. The judgment that the law firm Reed Smith seeks to enforce is now the subject of a grand jury investigation by the Attorney General of Pennsylvania, who alleges that the litigation costs that Reed Smith is now seeking to collect.
I don't see how we can inquire into any of that in this case.
Well,
you can make those allegations against Reed Smith, the Democrat Party, and they may or may not be true, but I don't see how this case is about that. You're supposed to be suing them for a conspiracy that involved the electoral process in 2004, and you want us, as part of that, to make a collateral attack on a final judgment in another court in another state,
Your Honor,
immediately enforced by a judgment of another court in this jurisdiction?
Your Honor, we are not asking this court to recognize a collateral attack on that judgment. We are simply saying that the proceedings in that matter are ongoing, and they are further evidence of the wrongful and tortious abuse of process, which
is still our habit. We have talked you way past your time, so unless one of my colleagues has a question.
I just have a question or two about the merits, because we've spent so much time on the statute of limitations, we haven't let you get to that. So I just have one or two questions about it. Your theory is that, the theory of your case is that the defendants conspired to file a series of cases that are, in essence, malicious prosecution, right?
And abusive process.
And abusive process, right, okay. Now, an element of any malicious prosecution case is, you know, lack of probable cause or objectively baseless, right?
Yes.
Okay. They sued in 24 states. They prevailed in five of them, right?
They prevailed on the merits in four states, Your Honor, and right. In a fifth state.
Yeah. So doesn't that suggest that their strategy was not objectively baseless?
Well, Your Honor, the fact that they may have won a few lawsuits certainly doesn't say anything about the overall pattern when the overwhelming...
Doesn't that say that at least those lawsuits have to drop out of this litigation? Because obviously they had probable cause if they won.
Your Honor, the case law does say that a winning lawsuit is generally recognized as one that has been initiated with probable cause. However, the District of Columbia does recognize an exception where the underlying judgments are procured by fraud or other misconduct.
Yeah. You're missing my question a little bit. Your theory is that there was this conspiracy to file these lawsuits, and that was, to use the language of the Supreme Court, objectively baseless, right? That there was no objective basis for these in law, correct?
Correct.
Okay. And you in your complaint, you do not go through each individual complaint, each individual case, and allege that each individual case was objectively baseless or without probable cause. So my question is that since your argument is that it was the decision to file this series of 20-plus cases that's the heart of the conspiracy, how can you prevail if they won in four or five of them? How could their strategy have been objectively baseless or without probable cause? They won some and lost some.
Your Honor, we do mention in our brief that many of the complaints were objectively baseless.
I'm talking about your complaint.
Pardon me?
In your complaint, you indicate which ones they won and lost, but there's no indication in count two that any of these were objectively baseless or without probable cause. But the fact that they lost doesn't mean they didn't have probable cause.
It does not necessarily right. mean that. But the complaint does contain facts which would allow a reasonable fact finder to conclude that this litigation was objectively baseless.
And how could they, since they won five of their cases?
Well, Your Honor, they won four, really, and they filed 29 complaints, 24 of which were dismissed.
Won half of them.
You're saying if they hit below 200, it's...
What's the number here?
Again,
suppose they won half.
Your Honor is correct to point out that this is a question of fact, and it should not be determined at this stage of the litigation. The point is that the amended...
The question is if one out of five, one out of six lawsuits mm-hmm. prevails, that's a strong indication that there's merit to this.
To, yeah. But if a lawsuit prevails in Ohio, it certainly doesn't have any indication about a lawsuit in Oregon or any
right,
other
but
state.
You're missing my point, which is that when you read your complaint, and you have to stand or fall on your complaint here, you don't allege that each of these individual lawsuits was filed without probable cause. You don't do that. At least I couldn't find it. So I read your complaint. I thought it was an interesting theory. I read it as saying it's this overall strategy that is the heart of the conspiracy. And so I thought, okay, if that's the overall strategy, then we test that as we test any malicious prosecution case by the question of whether it's baseless. And I wondered, how could it be baseless? How could their overall strategy be baseless if they won in four or five cases? I mean, after all, our elections, presidential elections, are carried on state by state. That's the only way people wishing to challenge a candidate's qualifications to run a state is to file in many, many states. So if they have, so since they won four or five of them, it's hard for me to see how this could be objectively baseless. And this is a motion to dismiss. We accept the facts and your complaint is true, and accepting them as true, I don't see how someone could conclude it's objectively baseless.
Well, Your Honor, these cases were litigated, first of all, at breakneck speed during the crush of an election cycle.
Right.
And certainly a small number of them, the defendants did prevail in those underlying actions. However, there are now allegations in the amended complaint that indicate that the judgments were procured by improper purposes. For example, in Pennsylvania, where the grand jury investigation is ongoing, 7,000 fake signatures planted in the Nader Kameho nomination petitions.
The issue was completely litigated in Pennsylvania, wasn't it?
It was, Your Honor, but brings
up my second question. I'm glad you raised this.
Just correct myself?
Please.
That issue was not actually litigated in Pennsylvania. The Pennsylvania challenge to the nomination petitions was litigated.
Yeah.
But the issue of whether there were fake signatures or other criminal conduct associated with the challenge was never litigated. And that is really what this complaint gets to. Did the defendants in this case cross the line between genuine petitioning conduct?
Didn't Mr. Nader ask the Pennsylvania courts to reopen its judgment on that issue?
Your Honor, we did, and that case is currently pending on appeal before the Pennsylvania Supreme Court.
This gets to my second question, which is this. Let's assume we agreed with you that it's not barred by the statute of limitations and that there is enough in this complaint to have this case go forward, and we send it back to the district court, okay? So what law is the district court going to apply to evaluate this? Is it going to look to D.C. law? I mean, the case is in the district court here, right?
Correct.
So it's going to look to D.C. law, correct? On malicious prosecution.
And abusive process.
And abusive process, right. You can assume I always mean abusive process.
Very good.
Okay. It's going to look to D.C. law to evaluate cases in many other states, right?
We think that would be correct, yes.
So we're going to subject Pennsylvania to the Pennsylvania courts the standards for malicious prosecution in Pennsylvania to D.C. standards?
Well, Your Honor,
you don't really mean that, do you?
Your Honor, this court has applied the law of D.C. in conspiracy cases where the tortious conduct takes place not only in the District of Columbia but all over the country.
But this is a situation where you have 50 different states with 50 different election systems. Right, and the line between and all the states, it's not unusual to have litigation challenging the qualifications of a candidate to be on a ballot. I mean, that happens in all these elections, right? And the line between what is malicious prosecution and what isn't is a touchy line. It's not clear, and it could easily and probably does vary from state to state. In fact, wouldn't you think that you would expect states to have different standards for that? Yet under your theory, we would have kind of a uniform standard based on D.C. law. All states would be subject to the same standard.
Actually, Your Honor, based on my...
How's that going to work?
Based on my review of the case law applicable in all 17 states, they're virtually identical.
What's virtually identical?
The elements of the torts of abusive process and the elements of the torts of malicious prosecution.
But there's no uniform standard. I mean, maybe they're close. My guess is they are close, but there may be, and the statutes may look similar, but there may be different state interpretations of them. One state may tolerate a certain type of litigation that another state simply unprepared to tolerate.
Again, so this becomes a choice of law issue, and certainly the district court could determine that it was appropriate to apply the law of the forum state, or it could determine that under the District of Columbia choice of law doctrine,
so,
the D.C.
so
law...
So then you're going to have the... Let's just, either way, then, you're going to ask the district court here to second-guess the decisions of the Pennsylvania court, right?
No, Your Honor, yeah. Because, again, the...
The Pennsylvania court said the suit there was not malicious.
Your Honor, no, the Pennsylvania court did not address this issue or any other
Can
issue.
Can you say it's now pending?
The case that is pending before the Pennsylvania Supreme Court is a petition to set aside the judgment awarding the law firm Reed Smith $81,000.
But the question of whether the ballot access suit in Pennsylvania was malicious prosecution was resolved against you, correct?
No, Your Honor. The question was never raised and never decided.
You lost that case.
It was, right?
You're saying because of the favorable termination element of the tort.
Right.
Well, again, I would like to emphasize that
we are
raising claims for abuse of process here as well. And I've already mentioned that...
I'm not sure that I understand them.
Okay, well, I think it would be useful to return to that point then, because the point here is that the process...
You could lose on malicious prosecution and still claim the same case was an abuse of process?
Your Honor, often the same case gives rise to claims for both torts. Abuse of process...
But when it gives rise to the second one, there's something done in the case that's done for an improper purpose.
Correct.
I mean, an extrajudicial.
And if I could address that point, the improper purpose here was the use of these lawsuits and this litigation process taking place in 18 different states and the Federal Election Commission as a pretext for destroying a political campaign.
It may have been, in fact, was evidently a tactic to stop him from being on the ballot, stop him competing, but... That doesn't mean the lawsuit wasn't brought to stop him from being on the ballot. That's not an improper purpose. That's the purpose.
Your Honor, this becomes a question of fact, because the question here is, was the underlying lawsuit filed for what would be a legitimate purpose, which is to ensure that a candidate complies with state election laws, for whatever reason? That would be a legitimate purpose. It is not a legitimate purpose to file that lawsuit as part of an overall effort to bankrupt the candidate by means of the litigation process itself.
Ballot access lawsuits aren't brought to make certain, to have an injunction out of it to tell somebody how to obey the ballot laws. They're brought because there's a concern that someone shouldn't be on the ballot, isn't it? There's nothing improper with that.
Your Honor, I think
your opponent may not be properly on a ballot, and so you bring up ballot access.
Yeah. I actually think you're right. What you're saying makes sense to me, that the malicious prosecution claim and the abuse of process claim can't be identical. You must be right about that, but how do you distinguish this case I asked you about, Morpheus versus Baum, which is our decision? How do you distinguish that from this case?
Your Honor, I'm actually not familiar with the facts of Morpheus at this moment, but I can distinguish the two torts.
But my point is that in Morpheus, we said that because an abuse of process claim, just like yours, because an abuse of process claim included claims of malice and lack of probable cause, we construed it as a malicious prosecution claim. That's what we said it was. And subjected it to the one-year statute.
Correct. And if that's all that is alleged, then it may be the case that the only tort alleged there was a malicious prosecution. Mm-hmm. But the gist of the abuse of process claims in this case are that the process for challenging the sufficiency of a candidate's qualifications to get on the ballot was abused for the improper purpose of ensuring that that candidate could not be on the ballot even if he did qualify. That's the improper use of the statutes in each state.
How would that work? Even if he did qualify, he couldn't get a benefit because he didn't have resources anymore?
Correct, Your Honor. And that is, in fact, what happened, not only in the states where there was litigation, but, for example, in a state like California, which requires a significant expenditure of resources for a candidate to gain ballot access. The 2004 Nader Camejo campaign simply didn't have the resources to get on the ballot in California as a direct result of the fact that they were defending themselves before 19 different tribunals at the same time that they were trying to run for office.
I don't understand why that isn't just, isn't it exactly the same as malicious prosecution? Because you said to deny him the ability to run in the election even if he could qualify, right? That's what you say distinguishes malicious prosecution from abusive process. But that's exactly what the malicious prosecution claim would allege. Same thing.
I think Your Honor is correct to point out that these torts do not admit of easy distinction.
That's for sure.
But my response to you would be that the fact that a complaint states a claim for malicious prosecution does not preclude it from also establishing claims for abusive process.
Yes.
And in this case, the elements of abusive process are that litigation was filed for an improper purpose, and that it was done with an ulterior motive. We've clearly alleged those elements in this amended complaint. The improper purpose, as I explained, was to use the statutes that are intended to ensure that a candidate complies with state law for the improper purpose of keeping a candidate off the ballot, even if he did comply. And further underscoring that improper purpose.
In another case, how would you make that showing? Why wouldn't every action brought to on a ballot access action be subject to that?
Yeah.
Because again, the point of most of these actions is to keep your opponent off the ballot.
Your Honor is correct, and usually I would think somebody filing a ballot access challenge has, say, a partisan motive for doing so. The difference here is that we're not talking about one lawsuit. We're not talking about even three or four. We're talking about 29 complaints filed.
Well, how presidential elections are run on a statewide or state-by-state basis, as Judge Tatel suggested early on, wouldn't we expect precisely that?
Interestingly, Your Honor, not a single lawsuit was filed in 2008 against the Nader Gonzalez campaign. So I don't know. But what that points to, Your Honor, is that this is a question of fact. Was the 29 complaints filed in 2004 filed for the proper purpose of ensuring that a candidate complied with state laws, or were they filed for the improper purpose?
The purpose is to keep your opponent off the ballot, right? And is that? And you're saying that rises to the level of a tort?
No,
Every
Your
time
Honor.
A campaign?
No, Your Honor. The gist of the claim here is that the lawsuits were used as a pretext. Whether the candidate was actually kept off the ballot or not.
This is a pretext. I think everyone knows what they were used for, to try and keep him off the ballot where he couldn't qualify.
But Your Honor, whether they succeeded or not, as the defendant, Mr. Moffitt, admitted in the original quotation that Judge Tatel read, whether they kept the candidate off the ballot or not, that was just icing on the cake. What they were trying to do was bankrupt this candidate, destroy this campaign.
Okay, so your theory your theory then is that if they had filed, let's assume they won, the plaintiffs here won all 24 cases. That is, they kept Mr. Nader off the ballot in all 24 states. Yet you would still have a cause of action under your theory, right?
Because that is true, Your Honor. I think it would be much more difficult for me to make a case.
But under your theory, you would still have a cause of action if you could show that their purpose, in addition to keeping him off the ballot, was to force him to spend all his money.
Yes, Your Honor, and the reason is that it's a question of fact whether a lawsuit was brought for an improper purpose of bankrupting a campaign.
So if you file a series of lawsuits and you win, you can still be charged with conspiracy to file those lawsuits if you did so with a malicious motive. Right.
If you did so for the improper purpose, for in order to achieve a purpose that is not within the purview of the law.
If that was a standard, if the standard was that meritorious lawsuits could be considered malicious prosecution or abuse of authority because of the motive of the plaintiff, we'd have a much smaller caseload here.
Oh, yeah. We would have a smaller caseload, right, in state,
right,
courts that have domestic jurisdiction would have hardly any at all.
Right. Your Honor, we are not advancing that standard.
But
we are not saying...
Seem exactly to be saying even if they had won every case here, they could be found to have participated in a conspiracy because their purpose in filing 24 meritorious cases that they won was to force the defendant to spend a lot of money.
Your Honor,
right?
The flip side of that is you're going to, by your rule, every ballot access case from here on out is going to include a deposition where someone's going to be asked, okay, what was one of your purposes to drain their resources? And under your standard, if the purpose was to drain their resources, somehow that rises to the level of a tort.
Your Honor, I was responding to the specific question, what are the elements of a tort of abusive process? Abusive process does not require favorable termination in the underlying proceedings. That's why I responded. In theory, certainly, we could come before this court and allege that that there was an abusive process, even though 24 out of 24 underlying lawsuits succeeded. That would be a very difficult case to make, I think, because it's a question of fact whether the process was used for an improper purpose. In this case, we have
that's missing our question, because you seem to be saying that an improper purpose is enough even if there's probable cause in the underlying lawsuit.
Your Honor, it depends on which tort we're talking about. Now, malicious prosecution requires a lack of probable cause and favorable termination. Mm-hmm. I think that if you had 24 out of 24 winning lawsuits, it would be difficult to make a claim for malicious prosecution.
You would still be able to make a claim of abusive process under your theory, even though you lost all the lawsuits.
Your Honor.
You would say they had valid legal lawsuits, but they still lose in a case of abuse of process because they had mean reasons for bringing those valid legal lawsuits.
Not mean reasons, Your Honor. The dispositive issue is whether the process was used for an improper purpose.
And draining resources is the improper purpose, right? I mean, you've conceded that keeping somebody off the ballot is not, that's the purpose of these actions. That can't be the improper purpose you're talking about.
Improper,
it's got to be something more than that.
The improper purpose is using the litigation process itself to inflict direct injury.
Direct injury.
Financial harm,
financial,
yes, Your Honor.
So that's
and also,
that's what I'm saying under your rule, the new standard that would go forward is there's always going to be a deposition asking, was one of your purposes that to make them spend money? And the answer to that is always going to be yes.
Your Honor, if we could take a step back here, it seems like
what do you do with the fairly standard litigation practice of pursuing the litigation to drive up the opponent's cost to force a settlement? Is that abusive process?
Your Honor, these are very fact-intensive
questions.
You're
inflicting? I'm just trying to use your standard to apply to cases that I know and we see all the time in this court. That is a case where the process is being used to inflict financial damage,
right,
to produce a particular result. In your case, it's to keep Mr. Nader off the ballot. In my hypothetical, it's to force a settlement. What's the difference?
The difference is, of course, litigants always engage in these kind of tactics, and I think the cases explicitly recognize the fact that filing a counterclaim in order to coerce settlement, that's not enough to sustain a cause for abusive process. But that's not what's alleged here. What's alleged here, and I think what we're trying to get to is where does the standard fall, and do we face a slippery slope problem if the cause of action is recognized in this case? The answer, Your Honor, is that there's no slippery slope problem here when you are dealing with a fact pattern in which the defendants have filed 29 complaints, 24 of them failed, and they used these complaints again, as the amended complaint alleges, to prevent a candidate.
Well, only one of them had failed. Does that change anything legally?
Well, it makes our case stronger.
Suppose 23 of them had failed.
it makes the case much more difficult. But again, these are questions of fact that should not be tried at a motion to dismiss stage. If 29 complaints are filed for the improper purpose of preventing a qualified candidate from running for office, and 24 of those complaints were actually dismissed, found to be without merit, that permits a fact finder, as the court recognized in California Motor Transport, to conclude that the process here has been abused. And that is the paradigmatic example.
Any efforts in any of those individual cases to talk about malicious prosecution or to try and sanction the lawyers for Rule 11 violations or anything like that?
Your Honor, I was not involved in those proceedings, but I don't believe that there were ever those allegations. But again, Your Honor, at the time when those complaints
were... I'm not suggesting that's a deficiency. I just didn't know.
The coordinated nature of that effort was simply not available and disclosed to the plaintiffs at that time.
I'm done. Okay, I think we're through keeping you up here. 28 minutes and 50 seconds past your expiration.
That was one or two questions about the merits, wasn't it?
Yeah.
We'll hear from the... Appley.
Thank you, Your Honor, and may it please the court. Mr. Nader asks to proceed with this case on the basis of allegations in his amended complaint that indeed show nothing more than efforts by the Democratic Party and others opposed to his candidacy to avail themselves of established state procedures under state law to challenge his access to the ballot based on the failure of his campaign to meet the applicable requirements and qualifications in particular states. It is a routine practice. It happens, parties and candidates challenging each other's access to the ballot in every election cycle at all levels of a candidacy throughout the country. And in this case, it is clear that there was a reasonable basis for the challengers to pursue these state proceedings.
Why?
To achieve the outcome.
Because they won in four of them?
No, and in fact, Your Honor,
five of them.
Noel, it was actually, it's a different situation than that. There were 18 states in which challenges were brought. In five of those, the challengers ultimately prevailed and Mr. Nader and his running mate were kept off the ballot. But in another five of the remaining 13, there was a finding for the challengers at some point in the proceedings.
That's my only question to you was, is that why this isn't malicious prosecution? Because they won some of their cases?
Well, they won a majority of it at some point. It is true that they ultimately didn't prevail, but in five of the remaining 13 where the candidates were on the ballot.
Forget the specific numbers.
Forget
the specific numbers. You said that these are just run-of-the-mill, ordinary ballot access cases that were not malicious. And I said to you, were they not malicious because they won some of them? Is that why?
The fact that they won at some point the majority of proceedings in the states who were brought clearly indicates that there was probable cause and therefore central element of the toward a malicious prosecution.
What about the central element missing? What about in the cases they lost?
The fact that a case is lost doesn't indicate lack of probable cause or that it was objectively baseless. To the contrary, if you're arguing about, or if this case is about, as Your Honor had suggested earlier, a pattern or an overall strategy, the fact that in 10 of the 18 states, the challengers prevailed at some point in the proceedings is determined by an independent tribunal, a state election board, a state lower court, is clearly indicative that there was probable cause for purposes of the elements of malicious prosecution.
Let me ask you about something different than what you're talking about here, unless I'm interrupting Judge Tatel.
No.
On the statute of limitations question, is there a procedural difficulty with us deciding this case on that basis when the district court hasn't passed on it?
No, Your Honor. We believe that the statute of limitations affords an independent ground for the court to uphold the judgment of the district court because the allegations of the complaint on their face indicate that the claims were time-barred because...
That's normally an affirmative defense. Can we pass on that without the district court having offered an opportunity for, I guess there was an opportunity for argument, but where the district court hasn't passed on that, or do we have to send that back for its determination?
We believe that, no, Your Honor, the case would not have to be sent back to the extent, which we believe is the case here, that the allegations of the complaint on their face indicate that the claims are time barred and consequently that there could have been a motion to dismiss under 12b6, Rule 12b6 granted on that basis as a matter of law.
Wasn't that argued from the district court?
The statute of limitations was argued before the district court. The district court determined to resolve the case on other grounds, believing that the inherently, or as an abstract matter, statute of limitations issues can raise issues of fact, but in this case, there really are not such issues of fact. The allegations on their face indicate that these claims were time, the last, there's no dispute between the parties that the D.C. law applies, 1 year statute of limitations for malicious prosecution, and the last of these claims would have accrued at the end of October of 2004 when the last of the proceedings, which they prevailed on, allowed them to get on the ballot, was finally resolved.
Do you need to prevail on the 1 year, on your argument that it's a 1 year statute? I mean, suppose we thought that there was an abuse of process claim here.
In the first instance, Your Honor, it's difficult to ascertain that there is any abuse of process
claim. We thought there was.
Well, there was no...
Can you win on a 3 year statute of limitations?
We can win on a 3 year statute of limitations because there was nothing in the any of these original proceedings, any of the collateral proceedings that went beyond that. Of course, the bill of costs proceeding is still going to enforce a bill of costs that was imposed by the Commonwealth Court in Pennsylvania in 2004. But it's impossible for us to see how that could give rise to an abuse of process claim. Because in that situation, the Commonwealth Court finding abuses, lack of cooperation, and fraud on the part of the Nader campaign essentially took it upon itself to ask the plaintiffs to, or the challengers in that case, to present a bill of costs. And that's not inherently something that can give rise to an abuse of process claim. With respect to the, again, back to the elements of malicious prosecution, in addition to lack of probable cause, of course, the plaintiff also has to make allegations that would demonstrate malice and special injury. The plaintiffs here, Mr. Nader and the other plaintiffs, have repeatedly argued that the challengers filed 29 complaints before 19 tribunals within 12 weeks. But as was pointed out in the previous argument, anybody challenging the candidacy, ballot access of somebody running to president has to do so in multiple states because a candidate for president, whether a major party nominee or an independent or third party candidate, runs in all 50 states. And the time period in which those challenges have to be brought is necessarily short because the state laws provide a limited period of time after petitions have been filed in the case where state law makes the filing of petitions the condition for an independent candidate to obtain ballot access. The time period for challenging those petitions under state laws is very short. Typically, they have until mid or late summer to file the petitions, and then, of course, the ballots have to be prepared, and so the deadline for filing the petitions is typically a few weeks or as little as 1 week in some states. So no malice, we would submit, can be inferred from the allegations about the number of states or the complaints filed. And then with respect to special injury, again, alluded to in the argument of counsel for the candidates.
Suppose the plan here, the lawsuits, suppose the challengers had lost all of the lawsuits. All of them.
That would not in and of itself indicate a lack of...
Yeah, I agree. You have to show lack of probable cause also.
Yes.
But suppose the candidate Suppose it was an effort by a party to, suppose in an election there was a third party candidate who was, you know, running 30% in the polls, okay? And the Democratic Party filed 20 or 30 lawsuits to force the defendant to spend a lot of money, and they lost all their cases. Would that get close?
Not necessarily, Your Honor. It depends on
what there's no way that a case like this could be pled properly?
It could be. If in Your Honor's hypothetical.
Yeah, what's missing here?
If in Your Honor's hypothetical, there was
how would you right. plead the case?
Well, if the decisions in those cases, let's say you say give the hypothetical where the challengers have lost 30 cases, if in those court decisions or determinations by the state election boards there were Rule 11 sanctions or indications that the challenge was baseless, or the nature of the proceeding was such that it was clear that there were tens of thousands of signatures over the limit, there was no basis for bringing it, that could be a situation in which there might be
lack of
probable cause.
Would that evidence have to be in each individual case?
It would have to be in probably in multiple cases, but if that evidence even existed in a handful of the 30 cases in Your Honor's hypothetical, it might make an action for malicious prosecution, but the opposite is the situation here.
Same question I asked your opponent here, which is that how would the district court decide that? What law would he apply, or she?
The district court would apply District of Columbia law, and in terms of the lack of probable cause, one would be able to look to the decisions, the official decisions of the election authorities and courts of which it could take judicial notice, and the allegations of the complaint, limiting itself to that, whether the allegations meet the objectively baseless or lack of probable cause standard.
So you'd have D.C. law deciding this for all states.
That's our understanding of how.
Suppose you had a particular state. Suppose, for example, Missouri. Suppose the Missouri courts are very, very worried about malicious prosecution cases in ballot situations. Okay, they're worried about the First Amendment consequences of it, right? So they have a very, very high standard to prove malicious prosecution in cases where there's any potential First Amendment implication, all right? That's what the Missouri courts have concluded. But the DC courts maybe aren't so worried about that. You know, they just apply standard malicious prosecution principles to any malicious prosecution case. So now what you have is a situation where you would have the D.C. standards substituting for Missouri's well-defined First Amendment-sensitive standards.
I think in that situation, Your Honor, the issue of the proper resolution of the conflict of laws, which was not really a contested issue between the parties in this case, would become pertinent.
You then apply Missouri law in that situation.
There would be an issue as to whether, because of the under conflicts of law principles, whether because that state had expressed a particular interest and the law was radically different, whether in fact D.C. law could be uniformly
applied. What's missing here is, from your perspective, I take it, is number one, they didn't lose all the cases, right? And number two, there's no evidence in any of, and I ask, I think this is right, I assume this is what you'd say, there's no evidence that in any of the individual cases that there was baseless litigation.
Exactly.
But what about their charges that, you know, there was fraud and in terms of signatures and other behavior? They allege that.
They allege in two states.
It's a motion to dismiss.
Right.
They have to accept that as true.
There are detailed allegations that can be examined on their face, and they're made in only with respect to two states, Pennsylvania and Oregon. In Pennsylvania, they allege that there were 7,000 fake signatures put in by the candidates, and they allege in that same paragraph or series of paragraphs that they discovered it before the petitions were submitted and eliminated all but about 600 of them. And the Commonwealth Court, in fact, found that they fell thousands of signatures short. The point being that they could, it's not clear whether they did litigate it, but they clearly could have litigated that issue before the Commonwealth Court in Pennsylvania. And they're now asking, in effect, this court to review and reopen that state court proceeding. Similarly, the Oregon Supreme Court, in its decision, made clear that the striking out of signatures about which the plaintiffs complained, first of all, didn't invalidate the petitions, but in any event, the discussion by the Oregon Supreme Court makes clear that that issue was, or at least certainly could have been, litigated by the candidates, Mr. Nader and his running mate, in those state court proceedings. In both of those cases, those states, the only states in which they make these allegations about fraud on the part of the challengers, the decision was not only fully, the facts were not only fully litigated, but the cases went to the highest court of each state. In the case of Pennsylvania, the Supreme Court denied certiorari ultimately. So we would submit that on its face, again, taking account only of the allegations in the complaint and the reported decisions of which, or the court decisions of which the court could take judicial notice, that there's no basis for
let me take you back
finding
to the
lack of probable cause.
Yeah, let me take you back to the statute of limitations. Mr. Nader says counsel acknowledges the newspaper articles that I read to him, but he says yeah, they're there, but there are also allegations that that the defendants were at the same time lying about the conspiracy, covering it up. And so, yeah, there were those newspaper articles, but there was really no way of knowing at that time that there was this conspiracy, particularly since they were denying it. And he says, for example, in paragraph 64, he says that he alleges that the DNC says all these suits were done by the state parties, not by the DNC. In paragraph 65, they quote Senator Kerry as saying he wouldn't attack Mr. Nader in any way. Reed Smith denies that it had been retained. There's three of them. So they say, look, it's unreasonable, no reasonable person with that kind of conflicting evidence would have thought at that point that there was a conspiracy.
The allegations do not show any fraudulent concealment or effort to conceal the involvement of the Democratic Party. Many of these proceedings were brought in.
One of the allegations says the Democratic Party said they were initiated by the state parties.
Well, they were initiated by the state parties, but they did. There was not a denial that the DNC supported it, or that there was never an expression the DNC wasn't in any way involved in the litigation. And the relationship between the DNC and the state parties is fairly well known. They're part of the same basic party structure. There's nothing here that shows that there was any concealment of any of the facts on which they rely, on which they would have to use to make a case. But the other key point about this is that the fact that there was agreements or discussions that could give rise to a claim of conspiracy that they didn't know about or even were concealed at the time doesn't take away from the fact that there's no independent tort in the District of Columbia for civil conspiracy anyway. They have to show the underlying tort, and they don't have that. So if there was concealment of that the defendants had agreed to commit some acts, in this case bringing the lawsuits or bringing a challenges to Mr. Nader's ballot access, which in fact were not tortious in themselves because there was plenty of probable cause to do it, it's really not the allegations of concealment, even if these could be so construed, would be beside the point.
Thank you, counsel. Unless my colleagues have further questions, I'm sure that counsel had no time left. We'll give you back 2 minutes for rebuttal.
Thank you, Your Honor. I just wanted to address a couple of points. Virtually all of the important issues that we've discussed here today rely upon questions of fact. Whether the cause of action accrued and therefore whether the statute of limitations applies depends upon a question of fact. Whether there was probable cause to initiate the underlying proceedings, whether the underlying proceedings, the complaints in those proceedings were objectively baseless, those are questions of fact. This is manifestly not to be decided upon a motion to dismiss.
Do you think you can never decide a motion to dismiss on statute of limitations grounds?
Well, as Your Honor has indicated...
I mean, a statute of limitations issue on a motion to dismiss.
I think I got the gist. As Your Honor has indicated, where the facts on the face of the complaint prove conclusively that an action is time-barred, then that would be appropriate, as the cases indicate. But this is a very high standard. Mm-hmm. The standard is whether the cause of action can be identified to a degree that no reasonable person could dispute. That has clearly not been met here. We have allegations of fraudulent concealment. There's ongoing conduct in continuance of this continuing tort. This motion, this case cannot be determined on a motion to dismiss based on those facts. Furthermore, we didn't really get to this issue in the previous my previous time, but
I
did
want to rebuttal of something he said. You're rising in rebuttal now. If it's something that hasn't come up yet, you don't have time for that.
Okay, then I won't get into that, Your Honor. I would just like to say in conclusion, there must be a remedy for this conduct. We're talking about 29 complaints filed with the explicit purpose to destroy a political campaign during a federal election to prevent voters from having the opportunity.
Destroying campaigns, that's ordinary sport. I mean.
Well, Your Honor, it's never happened before.
Been an attempt to destroy campaigns
It's never happened before.
Where have you been for the last couple of centuries, Jess?
Your Honor, it's never happened before that a major party has engaged in the kind of conduct that is set forth in detail in the amended complaint, which alleges this nationwide effort to use state court proceedings and Federal Election Commission proceedings to bankrupt a competitor to prevent voters from having the choice of voting for that competitor.
Your time is up. Unless my colleagues have questions, the case will be submitted. Give us recess.
Thank you.